Welcome to Common Thread. We hope you find these lessons helpful, but also we'd like to get to know you. If you go to our website /newcomer, we'll send you an email, some things to read about the community, and an invitation to a personal chat. If you're here in Raleigh, maybe face-to-face. If not, on Zoom. We hope you will. CommonThreadChurch.org/newcomer. Okay, here's the lesson. So the word oneness seems a little bit woo-woo. Everything is connected. But it turns out that's a real thing. It turns out it is a bedrock foundation of the reality that we live in. And our ancient texts and our spiritual masters intuited it a long time ago, but our quantum physicists have now come and confirmed it. Connectedness is the essential nature of everything that is. So in a very real way, everything is connected. But we heard last week from Einstein, we live our everyday lives in a kind of optical delusion. We see ourselves and we see the world wrapped in bundles of separateness. So we dismiss oneness, or more likely we just look away from it, not intentionally, but just instinctively, because we don't feel the connectedness of everything. We feel just the opposite. We feel separated from everything. We feel separated from everybody, which is a problem at the most basic level, the level of the framing stories we tell ourselves about the world that we live in and the world that we are creating. Because what we do is we build our worlds on top of, on the foundation of, the core stories we tell ourselves about the nature of things. We have these core meaning-making narratives, and we build our worlds upon that. And when we build on a two-ness world, when we build on a two-ness story, the world that we build is a world that hurts. It hurts us. It hurts everybody. You're going to hear a refrain in today's lesson. It's the story that always gets us. It's the story that always gets us. So here are the questions that we're going to talk about after to give you some time to be thinking. And please do remember to post any questions you have, any comments you have in our What Are You Thinking chat group. One of the negative consequences of building on a two-ness worldview is a culture of humiliation. That's what we're going to look at today. Today we're going to look at how we have normalized humiliation in the course of our social discourse and how negatively it impacts us. So I'll put the questions back up toward the end of the lesson, but to give you time to think, where have you seen? You're going to hear me talk about a dignifying, humiliating pattern. Where have you seen it? And as we did with shame, let's be thinking together about what would anti-humiliation look like? What would anti-humiliation look like? Okay. I am sorry. I have to tie my shoe. I looked down and it was flopping around there. Okay. You might have read about status anxiety. It's kind of a buzzword these days, and the reason is because it is a significant driver of the problems that we are facing as a nation. People and groups feel themselves ignored or feel themselves threatened. They feel themselves outside the sphere of acceptance, outside the sphere of belonging in our society, and are questioning, do I belong or do we belong? Am I respected? Are we respected? Am I valued? Are we valued? Which at the core is a two-ness question. Because once we ask if we belong or if someone else belongs, we've already determined that there are two, not one. There are those who belong and there are those who don't. So status anxiety and the politics of polarization begin with Einstein's optical delusion. There is a them to exclude. There is a them to disrespect, a them who belongs and a second them who does not belong. Well, if we build our lives on a truth, we say this all the time, if we build our lives on a truth that is not true enough, it'll eventually break down, it will eventually betray us. A few years ago, I talked about the spiritual implications of this TED Talk. You can Google it. The guy's name is Richard Wilkinson. He talks about inequality within societies. He's an epidemiologist and a social scientist, and here's what the talk says. A country can be poor or rich, doesn't really matter. Factoring in the health impacts of extreme poverty, if there is a big gap between those at the top and those at the bottom, all kinds of negative outcomes for a society. And it's less about the absolute numbers, and it's more about the relative numbers. How wealthy a nation is or isn't doesn't really factor in as much as how big the gap is between those at the top and those at the bottom. And in those nations that have a larger gap, there are all kinds of negative outcomes. Lower life expectancies, and that's not just for the have-nots in that society, that's for the haves and the have-nots, lower life expectancies. The bigger the gap, the worse the educational outcomes per capita in the society. The more bullying there is in schools, the higher the infant mortality rate, the higher the homicide and imprisonment and teen birth and obesity rates, the higher the addiction rates, mental health troubles. There's lower social mobility when there's a larger gap. Fewer that are born into poverty are able to get out during their lifetimes. And again, it's less correlated to absolute income and more correlated to how much inequality exists within the society itself. Because within a society itself, inequality income feels like a proxy for social valuation. In other words, when one group is way better off than another group, it says to the people in the society, you belong, but you don't. You get status, but you don't. You are respected, you are not. So when a society gets entrenched, as our society has become entrenched, in a two-ness narrative, a narrative of superiority and inferiority, who is good and who is bad, who belongs and who does not belong, rich, poor, educated, uneducated, Hutu, Tutsi, Turk, Armenian, Black Lives, Blue Lives, elites, or Main Street. When a society gets entrenched in two-ness, it sets up a competition for belonging. Status, competition, worth, respect, there becomes a competition. And it turns out that those feel to human beings, status and worth and respect, like a life or death struggle. When status is threatened, people chase the symbols of status, sometimes to their own detriment. People chase those symbols at the expense of relationships or at the expense of community. When social belonging is tentative, people worry more about losing the status symbols that they've got. How they are seen, they worry about that more. How they are judged, worry about that more. People struggle more with work-life balance because they feel that there is the pecking order that they live in, and they feel how tentative their place is in the pecking order, so they drive themselves all the harder to make sure that they don't lose their place in line. And that's what happens when a two-ness story takes root. As soon as that story takes root, there is a pecking order, and then the place that you have in the order starts to feel tentative. You may have status, but it's not a sure thing that you're going to be able to keep that status, so you better stay on guard. You better stay on guard. And the stress of that affects our health. We worry more and we worry about more stuff. We worry about our beauty inordinately. We worry about our aging. We worry about our intelligence or our success. We worry about what school our kids will get into. Well, on the other hand, societies that are not as stuck in two-ness narratives, or our own society just several decades ago, those societies live with a whole bunch less of that worry, of that anxiety, and a whole bunch less of all that negativeness, all those negative outcomes. Turns out, threats to social belonging evoke some of, if not the most, stressful hormone reactions, which makes sense from an evolutionary perspective because social outcasts don't survive the night out there with the wild animals. So we live in a time of high social anxiety. We live in a moment a very tentative belonging. And all that anxiety, you've seen it, drives our media, and it drives our politics, and it drives our identities, and it drives the competition we put our children into schools. It drives our society. We double down on a two-ness story, who belongs and who doesn't, who gets status, who doesn't, who is smart, who is dumb. And the more we do that, the more we generate a society of envy and jealousy and resentment. And when that happens, the more our politicians and our media leaders, who are pretty disinterested in the common good and very interested in clicks and eyeballs on screen and votes, the more they prey on our social anxiety, the more they peddle narratives of offense, being offended, or being under attack, or attacking. So this is my invitation this week as we consider this idea of institutionalized humiliation in our society. Let's together become keen observers of the social stories that we hear, that we see, and maybe start with a very critical exploration of your newsfeed. Look at every story that comes across your newsfeed very closely, especially the ones that are emotionally evocative. Many media outlets stopped talking about policy some time ago. They put the important debates about taxes or budgets or debt ratios, the size and the role of government or the military or markets, all those discussions got put on the way back burner so that we could move to the front of the politics of anxiety and the politics of attack. And so we've gotten quite accustomed to that. We've actually started to normalize it, the negative effects of soaking in a two-ness story. We've normalized the concept that there is a good us and an evil them. And we have normalized the anxiety that comes from that story, because anxiety is just in the air that we breathe together. There is a sense of constant threat. There is a sense that our belonging, our status are always under threat. We breathe in anxiety every day, and so we take pills. And so we externalize our internal anxiety and we put that energy onto someone else. Now, we are helped in this regard by our political and our media leaders. We put all of our anxiety energy onto other people. We off-gas that interior pressure by ginning up offense and ginning up outrage, and we tell ourselves that we're being attacked all the while we're doing the exact same thing and attacking others. And eventually we bash into a Capitol building, and as long as we keep promoting two-ness, belonging, not belonging, respected, not respected, heard, having a place at the table, not heard, not having a place at the table, as long as we keep doing that, we will keep living in a world with a them and an us, and our pain will not abate. But you people, you have a minister who cares for you deeply. And you have a minister who cares about the narratives that are shaping your instincts and his instincts. And that guy will spend weeks talking about two-ness stories, because it's the story that gets you every time. The stories about sin and about shame and about us and about them, because it is the story that gets us every time. Tell a two-ness story for very long, and what happens next is inevitable. Social marginalization happens next. Somebody will push somebody to the fringes. Now, maybe they'll stay there for a very long time. Maybe they'll stay there for 400 years, but they will not stay there forever, because the fringe will always push back. But if we don't change the story when the fringe pushes back, there's a good chance the fringe will just turn right around and socially marginalize somebody else and repeat the whole thing all over again, because it's the story that gets us every time. So for us, thinking about how we could become oneness people living in a two-ness world, a very good place for us to start is with watching. A very good place for us to start is seeing and noticing and observing. Because here's the thing, you cannot unsee something that you have seen. If we start to make critical assessments of the stories that we are being told, if we start becoming observers of the narratives that we are absorbing, we will begin to change. So my encouragement is to watch. Watch your newsfeed. Watch this Thanksgiving when you meet with your family. The conversations that happen there, or the conversations that happen at work, or the conversations that happen with your friends, and especially watch your own thoughts and watch your own words. That's probably the most difficult, but we can do it. We can be observers of our own words and ask ourselves, huh, what's the story that I'm being fed here? What is the anxiety that is being poked here? Because typically when your anxiety is poked, what you do is you just get anxious. But if instead of just getting anxious, you say, what is the anxiety that's being poked? What is the threat that is being highlighted here? Who is the boogeyman in this story? Who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? What is being sold to me? What is being told to me? And especially, let's watch for humiliation. Because it is insidious how we have normalized this toxic practice into our social dialogue. So let's watch for it. I couldn't find a picture of this guy. It's probably easy to find. I just couldn't find it. His name's Thomas Friedman. He's a New York Times columnist, and he wrote recently that he said, I changed my job description, put the new title on my card and everything. The card used to say foreign affairs columnist. Now it says humiliation and dignity columnist. Because basically he said it's my job to humiliate these people and to dignify those people. Steep a society in a two-ness narrative long enough, and that is what happens. Somebody goes to work every day whose job it is to dignify these people and to humiliate those people. Which might feel okay if you happen to be in the dignified group. If you got the right job, or if you went to the right school, or if you live in the right zip code, but here's the problem. Once a society sets up a dignify, humiliate pattern, the pattern itself takes on a life of its own. And when that happens, it gets harder and harder to stay in the dignified group because the pattern itself has needs. The pattern needs people to humiliate. The pattern needs people to outgroup. And so the pattern then creates people. It creates the people to be in the out-group because the pattern needs people to be in the out-group because the pattern needs some people to dignify and some people to humiliate. And then the pattern sends us out to go find those people and to start doing the dirty work for the pattern. And do that long enough, and pretty soon you can't do enough to stay in the dignified group. At some point, having enough money won't keep you in the dignified group. You got to know the code words. And then having the right code words won't be enough because you don't have the right code words. So it gets harder and harder to stay in the dignified group because lots and lots of people then begin to go to work every day whose job it is to intentionally and purposely every damn day make somebody else feel inferior, make somebody else look bad, intentionally humiliating somebody else. And it happens in the schoolyard, and it happens in our national life. Bullying might give a child a black eye, but when bullying that child makes them look bad in front of their classmates, the harm goes even deeper. Make a child or an adult feel inferior, feel stupid, feel unworthy, and do it in front of community, and we undercut social belonging, which is one of our deepest human drives. It's a power game, and it hurts everybody. Because once we start that game going, what goes around will eventually come around. By making somebody else look bad in front of the community, by undercutting their social status, undercutting their place in society. In the short run, we bolster ourselves or we bolster our own group, but damn, what a price we have to pay because what goes around does come back around. And when it does, some brain research out of the University of Amsterdam, just how powerful an emotion humiliation is. Dozens of participants reading short episodes while being hooked up to brain scans. And when the stories evoke humiliation, that is one of the biggest spikes that the subjects experienced in any of the many patterns, many episodes. Humiliation is an intense and it is a demanding negative emotional experience. and it has far-reaching consequences. Make somebody feel humiliated, and they will respond. And they will respond ferociously. Nelson Mandela once said, "There is nobody more dangerous than one who has been humiliated." There is nobody more dangerous than one who has been humiliated. So if you take just a quick survey, going in your own mind back over the violent riots that have erupted in our own nation, every time you can find at the core of that violent rioting some source of humiliation. So that foreign affairs correspondent, the one I told you that changed his title, later in the article, he highlighted how humiliation has played out in foreign policy. Vladimir Putin's macho persona and then violent push into Crimea shaped by Russia's humiliation after the Cold War. Ongoing violence in Iraq. The Sunnis were humiliated, pushed out of the army, pushed out of the government, stripped of rank, stripped of status. Palestinian suicide bombers daily humiliated at Israeli checkpoints. Violent Muslim youth in Europe humiliated by the Christian majority. China killing itself to become a dominant world power after what they call their century of humiliation at the hands of foreign powers. George Floyd was murdered, but the knee on his neck was more than murder. It was intentional humiliation. Now, we are all schooled now. We know the daily humiliations faced by people of color, so it's no surprise that the movement is named Black Lives Matter. The name wouldn't have stuck had Black Lives not been fed the narrative that you don't matter, you don't belong. And here's a daily dose of humiliation to remind you that you don't matter. And what happens next? Kind of inevitable. What happens next is rage. Those Amsterdam researchers, humiliation is as strong a human emotion as there is. Humiliation evokes rage. And if you noticed, there is plenty of rage going around these days. It's the story. It's the story that always gets us. Tell a Tunis story, a story with a them, and before long, we are competing with them for status. And somebody eventually gets less status, and then the pattern gets set up. Somebody gets dignified, and somebody gets humiliated, and rage. Burn the place down, kind of rage. So, again, a good place for us to start, our own journey becoming oneness people living in a two-ness world is to watch and to see and to notice. So, let's carefully monitor the stories that we hear this week and in the weeks before us, and let's even more carefully monitor the stories that we tell. Let's look for conversations that divide up the world, us and them. Let's look for ways in which some are afforded dignity and others are afforded humiliation. Now, for the most part, now there are some exceptions, and they are very notable when they happen, but for the most part, we all now know that it is against the rules to humiliate someone on the basis of race, or on the basis of gender, or on the basis of sexuality or disability. We know that. So collectively, at least we bite our tongues, maybe we're doing better, but whatever, we don't do it because it's socially inappropriate. But there are two areas in which we are still allowed to humiliate people with impunity. We can humiliate someone for their political party, and we can humiliate someone for their educational status. Because you chose your party. You weren't born that way. You chose to be part of that party. You chose not to get a four-year degree. Whatever happens next, it's your own damn fault. And so, with impunity, our society has made it okay to look down upon, even publicly, those two categories of people. Let's talk about that second one. You stupid people, you uneducated people, you are so dumb. You are so gullible. No wonder you do X or Y or Z. You're just not smart like us. You should have gone to school. This is a really important book. I hope you put it on your holiday reading list along with the two that I mentioned in the last part of the lesson. Our society has condoned humiliating people, congratulating winners and denigrating losers on the basis of education. go to the right school, learn the right code words, get the secret decoder ring so you know all the hidden beliefs and all the hidden values so you can spout all the right phrases like inductive reasoning or like evidence to support presuppositions. Do all that and you belong. Clearly, you are now part of the creative class. Clearly, you now are among the new educated elite. It is no longer that we become elite because of our wealth. Now we become elite because we are in the know, and we know how to navigate the right words, the right phrases, the right sensibilities, and we know who's in, and we know who is out. And we have sold this story, especially the education story, so well that even those on the short end of the stick end up buying into the story. Well, they have to. They have to because they find out how powerful that story is as soon as they show up to get a job. Because the story decides who gets hired and who gets hired for what. With a four-year degree, you get dignity work. No degree, sorry, only humiliation work for you. This kind of work, the dignified kind, it requires this degree from that school. That kind of work, humiliating work, it does not. We've actually redefined the status of work on the basis of credentials that are required. The trades require a tremendous amount of skill, and they are highly paid, but not much status there. But look over here, lower skills required, lower pay on the job, but requires a credential, and now that's some dignified work right there. That work matters. That work gets status. So we tell ourselves a story, all the while hiding from ourselves how we've rigged the game, all the while hiding from ourselves a lot of really relevant information. But in the process, we tell ourselves a story that it is okay to look down on some people and feel good about it because they chose their path. It's their own damn fault. Now, when you hear that out loud, it really is crazy. I mean, can we even buy that we tell ourselves that story? But we do tell ourselves that story. We know it's a faulty story because only a third of all people in our nation qualify for dignity, and two-thirds qualify only for humiliation. That's a crazy story. But again, it's the story that gets us every time. First, the Tunis story, then the competition for belonging, then the competition for status, then the dignity humiliation pattern, then the pattern takes on a life of its own, and if it wasn't education, the pattern would go out and find some other group to humiliate, because the pattern needs to create somebody to be an out-group. And if there is a Tunis story, there is going to be humiliation. All right, we're getting near the end, so there's the questions. Give you some time to be thinking. I heard a story in the 80s. A minister from a recovery church was talking about their inpatient treatment center, and two groups in that treatment center formed, an elite group and an inferior group. And the determining criteria was the kind of heroin they'd gotten addicted to. So I guess back then, one kind of heroin was better than the other kind of heroin. Everybody addicted. Everybody's life falling apart, but we are better than them. So dignity for us and humiliation for them. It's the story. It's the story that always gets us. As soon as we set up that there is a two-ness, the chain of events that follows will lead to where we are. Once there is a them, there will be a gap. Once there is a gap, there will be anxiety, and there will be humiliation, and there will be rage. So again, let's be watching. Let's be looking closely, alerted now at how normal we have made the art of humiliation. Let's be looking at how we have accepted the pattern of making someone else look bad in front of other people. Let's watch for the pattern, dignity for some, humiliation for others, and let's watch for what Mandela said, nobody more dangerous than the one who has been humiliated. And pray God, may we not get sucked into this toxic story. And pray God, may we instead be increasingly disentangled from it. Amen. Well, if you would, please prepare your offerings. And as you're doing that, let us remember that we all give online now. You go to our website. At the top, there's a donate button. And let us also remember that when we make an investment in spiritual community, when we invest our time and our energy and our love and the dollars that it takes for us to be a healthy financial community, what happens to that is a fantastic return on investment, because what the community does is take all of that love and energy and dollars and turn it around and give it back to us in the form of a transformative environment in which we are changed. So, great return on investment. If you have not been giving to the community, it's a great thing to do. If you have, thank you so much. All right, in a moment, let's see what comes next. Oh yeah, there we go. In a moment, we are going to dismiss the folks on the live stream, and we're going to do the stuff on the wall right here. But before we do that, if you will, oh, by the way, those of you on the live stream, I keep asking, I am looking for more facilitators to do a what are you thinking Zoom afterwards. Got two, need four before we get started, because that way we can share the burden. If you'd like to do that, let me know, use the contact us button. So if you would, let's us here in the room put our hands on our hearts, and as we're getting ready to dismiss them, and let us remember as we go that we are, every one of us, carriers of the indwelling divine. Love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness are in us because we carry the very Spirit of God, the very breath of God. And if you would extend your other hand to our city, let's look for opportunities to share what's in us with the people that we live and work and go to school with, looking for opportunities to repair and heal our worlds. Amen. God bless you all. You are dismissed. The questions are in the live stream notes. You can have that conversation at home. And those of us here, let's begin to count off in groups of five. So,
we'd love to connect with you in real life. CommonThreadChurch.org/newcomer. And if you'd like to take an ownership stake in the well-being of the community, we all contribute online. You'll find a donate button at the top of our website. See you next time. We'd love to connect with you in real life. CommonThreadChurch.org/newcomer. And if